From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The motion to override prevails and House Bill 3796 is declared passed, notwithstanding the governor's recommendations for change.
When asked, shall the minimum wage in Illinois for adults over the age of 18 be raised to $10 per hour by January 1 of 2015, 67% of the voting people in Illinois said yes.
I had a very cordial call, a very gracious call from Representative Tom Cross this morning. He called to concede, admit in this race, that he's not going to pursue a recount going forward. And we had a good conversation about the direction the state needs to be going.
Thank you. It's exciting to be here. It's terrific to be in Springfield. Looking forward to this being new home, January 12th. We just had a meeting with Leader Redonio and Leader Durkin. This afternoon, I'll be meeting with Attorney General Lisa Madigan. I'll be meeting with Treasurer-elect Mike Frericks. We are also today asking Governor Quinn's staff to please put in place a hiring freeze, an appointment freeze, and a reclassification freeze for all positions inside state government.
Sounds from the first week of the legislative veto session in Springfield. That was Bruce Rauner, who visited the State House for the first time since he was elected to be the next governor of Illinois. Before that, we heard from Democratic State Senator Mike Frericks, who won the very close race for state treasurer, and State Senator Kim Lightford, also a Democrat, urging fellow lawmakers to increase the state's minimum wage. We'll get to all of that, but up top, we'll be talking state pensions. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Brian Mackey with WUIS and Illinois Issues, and at our State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS, Amanda Venicky. And Amanda, the state pension overhaul ruled by a circuit judge to be unconstitutional, and you've examined the ruling. Tell us about it.
Sangamon County Circuit Court Judge John Bells says that it could not have been more clear that any attempt to diminish or impair pension rights is unconstitutional, and he says that's just what this law does. He goes on to write, therefore, that it is unconstitutional and void in its entirety.
Now, it's ruled unconstitutional by a circuit court judge popularly elected by state employees in a state and government town. It will go to the Supreme Court, most likely. Is that a good...
Well, the Attorney General has already said that she is going to immediately appeal to the state Supreme Court and is asking for that to be done on an expedited basis, given how important this is to the state's fiscal situation.
Charlie Wheeler is...
I would argue that this particular decision should come as no surprise to anyone who is reasonably literate and speaks the English language, because as Judge Bells pointed out, the Constitution says in clear and simple terms, you can't do this. And the rationale that the defenders of this law attempted to put forth that, oh, we have to use our police powers because this is such an emergency and blah, 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 Belts in essence says the court finds as a matter of law that the defendant's affirmative matter provides no legally valid defense. And he says, because the act diminishes and impairs pension benefits and there is no legally cognizable affirmative defense, the court must conclude that the act violates the Pension Protection Clause of the Illinois Constitution. The court holds that Public Act 98-599 is unconstitutional. And so it was pretty clear, and as I say, not to be too snarky, but anybody who could read the Constitution couldn't come to any other conclusion that, yeah, you can't do it. As a matter of fact, if you go back and read the debates at the time the delegates added this provision to the proposed new Constitution back in 1970, this issue was raised. Hey, if you put that language in, legislature won't be able to cut benefits in the future. And the sponsor said, yeah, well, no kidding. That's the whole point.
I think you're right, Charlie. This is not surprising coming from a trial judge because there have been precedents here that he was following. He cites recently the case of Canerva versus Weems, which was the Illinois Supreme Court ruling that the state could not charge retirees for health insurance benefits that it had previously said would be free. So you're right. I don't think it's surprising. The one thing that I would caveat in saying, like, if I was a state employee, and in fact, maybe this is a good point to point out that all four of us on the panel today are members of the state university's retirement system. Why state employees maybe should not be celebrating yet is that the Illinois Supreme Court is not bound by its own precedent. And, you know, one could imagine that if they chose to go a very different route, that they, you know, could make that decision to do that. We have no reason to believe they would go one way or the other yet. But, you know, like you said, this is...
Well, but I would argue that the case that was decided earlier this year over whether or not health insurance coverage has to remain free, the court, by a 6-1 decision, said that yes, because this is a constitutionally protected benefit. And the dissent wasn't over constitutional protection for benefits. It was whether this counts as health insurance subsidies, count as one of the benefits covered under the Pension Protection Clause.
Whereas this time the building is burning down. And last time they weren't mentioning the building was burning down to the budget.
Like I've told other people, the argument is, oh, the building is burning down. We have to break the windows. And I've suggested that maybe if the building is burning down, you don't necessarily have to break the windows. Maybe you could go to the front door and turn the doorknob and walk in.
Amanda, you were trying to jump in there.
I was just going to point out that the Canerva case did not rely on this pension police powers sort of argument that the Attorney General is making in this case. Their point is that this is a contractual relationship, and contracts do give the ability to modify terms when there are extreme situations, such as the fiscal one that Illinois is in.
You know, it's interesting. I think about the past times when governments have tried to go around constitutions citing emergencies. You think the famous examples are Abraham Lincoln suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War, right? I mean, that is obviously a truly national emergency. And I guess the people here are trying to claim that Illinois' budget situation is in a similar state of emergency. But as you have pointed out many times on this show, Charlie, that, you know, there are other options here. This is, you know, diminishing and impairing, as the judge put it, and as the Constitution put it, diminishing and impairing the retirement benefits is not the only way you can do this. You can raise taxes in any number of ways. You can change the funding scheme out into the future and stretch it over a much longer period of years than the current funding target in the, 2030s, 2040s, I think.
It's to 2045 or 2045. If it were 20,045, it'd be a lot easier.
Yeah. Question. They were going to ask that it be expedited. In reality, what does that mean for people that are watching this case closely?
I suppose what it means is that the court is being asked to take this up at a quicker pace than they normally do with appeals. The way the process works is that if you don't like a decision at the trial court, you can appeal to the appellate court. If you don't like that decision, you have the opportunity to ask the Supreme Court to hear your case. And every year the Supreme Court accepts less than 10%. Brian, you probably know better than I.
Yeah,
it's like
it's 5%. A pretty small percentage, yeah.
Yeah, of those petitions for leave to appeal. So in this case, what the Attorney General is asking is for the Supreme Court to immediately begin consideration of this. Now, the Supreme Court could grant that and schedule hearings, or the Supreme Court simply could issue an order saying, no, we don't want to get involved because we think Belt's got it right.
Or if they do say we're going to expedite it, what does that mean in terms of a timeline? Does that mean we'll hear it in 3 months or still a year? Or
that really depends on the parties, how quickly they file the briefs and counterbriefs and that sort of thing. The big issue here, and the reason people want to hurry, is that this is supposed to save the state a lot of money. They didn't count those savings in the current budget year. There's a huge budget hole we have to climb out of. And if, you know, this case drags on much longer, they're not going to be able to count those savings in the next budget year, which just makes the current budget situation of the state that much more difficult to solve.
And another reason that there's a lot of anticipation for a ruling from the state Supreme Court is because lawmakers are hopeful that it will provide some guidance as to what they could do going forward, if in fact the court finds that this law is unconstitutional and tosses it, what perhaps could the General Assembly do going forward to cut down pension expenses that would be legal?
You're listening to State Week in Review. We'll talk about the pensions more next week. Coming up, 2 weeks after the November election, we finally get results on the state treasurer's race.
Support for State Week in Review comes from Illinois Issues Magazine, a public affairs magazine deciphering Springfield legislation and the state of the state. This month's features include the plight of young African American males. Also, is Illinois facing a possible casino overload? Illinois Issues and its companion publication, The Roster of State Government Officials, is available at illinoisissues.uis.edu.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Amanda Vinicky, and I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Brian, Mike Frericks, Democrat state senator, is the treasurer-elect for Illinois, and one of those lower ticket races that doesn't always get a lot of attention, but it was a close race this year.
Yeah, and as Frericks pointed out, he had a news conference in the State House this week. He said it's gotten a lot more attention in the last 2 weeks after the votes were cast because it's been the only kind of election that has been this this long. We've been waiting to find out what happened to it. It's pretty extraordinary what happened here. This is the only statewide race that remained too close to call. The final tally of mail-in ballots, though, broke in Frericks' favor. It had long looked like, since Election Day, State Representative Tom Cross, a Republican from Oswego who used to actually be the House Republican leader. He stepped down from that to run for this office. He had been up by a few thousand or 20,000 votes, I think, almost, for the last couple of weeks. And then all of a sudden, kept getting tighter and tighter. And then towards this very end of the counting period, a lot of last-minute mail-in ballots and provisional ballots broke in Frerich's favor. This happened across the state in downstate areas. In Will County, we were surprised at how many people had gone for State Senator Mike Frerichs, and he is now the Democratic treasurer-elect of the state of Illinois. There had been some question about whether Cross might ask for a recount here, and it seems like the final count, even though it's only about 9,600 votes, according to Frerichs, which is a fraction, a quarter of a percent of the more than 3 million votes that were cast in this election, that Cross, had reportedly told Frerichs that he is not going to pursue a recount. He did concede.
He conceded. Charlie Wheeler, it is one of the closer elections we've seen in a long time. The last time there was one close was that you kept attention
was
to?
Was in 1982 when Jim Thompson beat the Republican incumbent governor, beat U.S. Senator Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic candidate, by a final official count of 5,074 votes. And that was one that wasn't decided until literally the eve of the inauguration, because there was some question about Stevenson wanting a recount, and ultimately the decision by the courts was Illinois did not have in place a law that would permit a recount. So that still is the tightest race ever. One of the things that occurred to me, which is, I guess, going to be how it is going forward, with the opportunity for people to register on Election Day, and with all the other early voting, provisional ballots, there's a good chance we'll see other close races not determined until after the final count occurs. And in this case, the election authorities across the states, the county clerks and the election commissions, had to tally up their final count by a deadline that occurred 2 weeks after the election. And there were a lot of that. There was an opportunity for people who voted absentee, put their ballot in the mail on Election Day, to allow the Postal Service to get it to the election authorities. There was this 2 week window. Plus, the provisional ballots all had to be checked to make sure that this person was, in fact, living at the address they said and was entitled to vote. And those kinds of things didn't exist 30 some years ago. And so I'm thinking going forward, people who are reporters, people who are interested in outcomes of races, whenever it's close, there's always going to be this uncertainty for a couple of weeks while these late results, or I'm sorry, these late ballots get tallied.
At least we'll see right now that day of election grace period registration was a one-time try for this election only, something that Republicans were, you know, suspicious of, that was part of this omnibus election bill passed at the end of the legislative session. We do have efforts now in the veto session from Senator Don Harmon to continue that, make this a permanent thing that lets people register the day of an election. And as many will remember, one of the lingering questions was in, you know, Chicago, where people were still lined up to vote at 3 o'clock in the morning, technically the day after the election on November 5th. And he says, you know, yes, that was a problem. And there are many who say this is wrong. That's not the way to do things. But he says, yeah, we don't need to change that in law. Election authorities will hopefully have learned their lesson and have more opportunities for voters. But he does want this as something that continue in the future to make more people, make it easier for them to cast their ballots and vote.
And I think the lesson for the election authorities in Cook County and the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners, particularly the Chicago Board, is you have to hire more people, have more polling places, have more judges on hand to accommodate people's interest in voting. I don't think there are those same problems anywhere else in the state. It just seemed to be in Chicago where you had these awfully long lines and you had, in essence, the court telling the election authorities you have to keep the polling place open past the normal 7 o'clock closing because people are there wanting to exercise their franchise.
There's one other point I wanted to make about this race that I think is interesting is how much better Frerichs did than Governor Pat Quinn, who obviously lost the election. This, you know, shows that there seem to be a substantial number of people who are willing to vote for a Republican for governor and a Democrat for treasurer. Now, I think treasurer is one of those races that political scientists will tell you the party ID matters a lot more than the actual name of the candidate because, you know, they don't have as much money for advertising. They're just not as well known. So I think that this does, when people look at Illinois and say, wow, did Illinois flip from blue to red? Well, obviously the state legislature is still firmly Democratic. We do have a Republican governor coming in, but I think the outcome in this race and also how close Sheila Simon came to beating Comptroller Judy Part Topinka, you know, people did not expect that race to be as close as it was. I think that does indicate that this is still generally a Democratic-leaning state, even though you had this one election where, you know, Pat Quinn was a uniquely, obviously unpopular candidate, and Bruce Rauner managed to win.
Brian Mackey.
And I saw some of this commentary asking about, oh, is Illinois now becoming a red state? I thought to myself, the people who make those comments are people who are clueless about Illinois. So, yeah, Bruce Rauner won. Oh, man. You know, the Republicans are sweeping the Midwest. Bruce Rauner spent upwards of $27 million of his own money to beat the governor who had the lowest approval rating of any governor in the United States of America. And he wins by, what, 5 points, by 160,000 votes? That, to me, is not some indication that Illinois is turning even a light shade of purple.
Bruce Rauner was at the Illinois State Capitol this week, Brian Mackey and Amanda Vinicky.
Yeah, he was here. He said he was meeting with the, as we heard at the top of the show, the Republican legislative leaders. He met with Senate President John Cullerton, Attorney General Lisa Madigan, Treasurer-elect Mike Frerichs. The list goes on and on. He also made a point to say that he was meeting with Auditor General Bill Holland and, you know, talked a little bit about how the dire fiscal condition of Illinois. I don't think that's news to anyone listening to this show. At least I hope not. It's certainly not news to anyone on the panel. But it did sound like he was, making it sound even worse than maybe it did before. It remains to be seen. He's been pretty tight-lipped about what he's going to do about the state budget. But just as a reminder, the budget that was passed by the legislature and signed into law by Governor Quinn does not have nearly enough money to get the state through the fiscal year because the tax rate, which is currently the income tax rate, is 5%. That's going to roll back on January 1st, leaving a huge revenue hole, billions of dollars. And so the budget address, Governor-elect Rauner is scheduled to make his budget presentation to the legislature in February. And we still want to know how he plans to fill that budget hole.
So he was coy about that. Something that he wanted to get out in front of his remarks and made news with was a request to outgoing Governor Pat Quinn to, there are some 50 days, give or take, before Rauner is to be inaugurated. And he says in that time, Quinn should lay off on any state hires as well as appointments or reclassifications of positions. That sounds technical, but that's kind of where you can get into this situation with IDOT and patronage hiring, what have you. And you've seen previous governors try that out and help their friends, their allies, the many people who are upset about this governor's race for not only ideological reasons, but because it means that they are soon to probably be out of work. And I think there are some questions as to, I mean, the practicality of it. Maybe it's not a big deal, but, you know, you have those who say, well, what if there's a big snowstorm and you have to hire some temporary employees to plow the streets or what have you? That's the sort of reaction that you got from Quinn's office. Not quite that. It was just a one-sentence statement that I think shows how very displeased, whereas Governor Quinn did eventually call Bruce Rauner and they had a brief chat. We've never, you know, seen congratulations or really referred to him by name or anything. The one-sentence statement from the Quinn offices was that agency directors had already been told, basically, manage responsibly and make sure that the basic operations of the state can continue to thrive. So we'll see, though, if Quinn does try to use that or maybe state contracts to reward some of those who've stuck with him and keep them on with government work in some way while Rauner takes over.
Other issues that Rauner brought up or was asked about while he was roaming around the Capitol?
He did talk about, and he did not, wasn't really. It's interesting you say that because this was a very staged press conference. It's not like we just, you know, we're sort of can bump into him and talk to him. He is, as he did all throughout the campaign, very carefully managing how much he is exposed to reporters' questions. So he had kind of set up in a very dark corner of the second floor outside the controller Judy Bartopinka's office.
But also interestingly, outside the offices of Quinn's top staff. I mean, it's a
back door too. Yeah, to Quinn's staff offices. Yeah, but he One of the other things he did talk about there is the executive mansion. He said he was going to visit the governor's mansion in Springfield with his wife. And, you know, he has repeatedly said during the campaign that he wants to live in Springfield. That would be quite a change of pace. Most recent governors, going back at least to George Ryan, I think, have chosen to live in or near Chicago, George Ryan from Kankakee, of course. And the mansion is in, reportedly in a pretty bad state right now. Flooding, leaks, furniture, kind of, musty
general
smells.
Outdated.
Yeah,
the
building dates to 1855. It's one of the oldest continuously occupied, such as it is, executive residences in the country. And it just needs some work. And so he did say that he wanted to assess that, see how he can restore it, and would use private money to do so.
The governor-elect was also asked, a couple of other questions. Really, people are trying to figure out what's going to happen with this tax increase. But there had been talk about his getting a PAC going to perhaps try and influence Republican members or members of the General Assembly. And that's something that he'd kind of hinted at previously, be it on radio programs. I believe he made some statements on WLS and also when his term limits constitutional amendment idea was knocked off the ballot, saying he wants to elect some of those members and he'll work for it. He said, no, he hasn't thought about that at all now. Talked about his many meetings with legislators. Rauner has said he wants to talk with every member of the General Assembly. And at last count, he had spoken with at least 50. So presumably more at this point. I know I spoke with legislators who said, yeah, I haven't talked with them yet, but they did leave a message with my office. They asked for my cell phone number, something that in all of the years of Governor Pat Quinn never happened. He never bothered to ask for it or have it. And that's already underway. So Rauner making headway. And I think legislators so far find that really refreshing.
The fall veto session was taking place at the state capitol. And one of the issues that was getting some attention was possibly increasing the state's minimum wage. Where does that stand right now after week one of the fall veto is complete?
It doesn't stand very much. It did get out of a Senate executive committee, but that's not a very difficult task. You had Republicans saying, hey, wait, the governor-elect has asked us to please not pass any major legislation. He wants that coupled with business changes. But Democrats rebuffed that. They said the people have spoken. We had this statewide referendum. That said, the statewide referendum left it where voters said the minimum wage should be $10. And this particular plan would bring it to that in July, but thereafter eventually bring it up in a couple of years' time to $11 an hour. Now, the sponsor, Senator Kim Lightford, says this is still open to some changes. She's negotiating, she's maneuvering. And so it is not clear if that will be the final version of this package, how much legislators care about fulfilling one of Governor Quinn's final wishes, if they do want to leave this on the table for next session or what have you. At this point, out of Senate Executive Committee, but don't make too much out of that.
What else is most significant do you see that potentially could be discussed in the fall veto leading into lame duck?
I can take that, actually. One of the things we did hear from are the executives at Uber, the ride-sharing company, as well as State Representative Mike Zaleski, who's been negotiating legislation there. This is ride-sharing is where you can have an app on your smartphone and you can page a car to you. It can either be like a fancy town car, livery-type vehicle, or it could just be somebody who meets the company's requirements and they show up with their personal car and can give you a ride and you just pay with your app. The taxi industry has not taken kindly to Uber's and other companies like its appearance here in Illinois, in Chicago. And they worked with the legislature to pass a bill that would require things like certain amounts of insurance. So that if you're in an accident with one of these ride-sharing cars, make sure you could actually get your medical bills covered, for example. Also talking about hour restrictions so that, they say drivers aren't driving too much in a row, for example, the way we have restrictions on pilots and trains. The governor and Bruce Rauner both agreed that this ought to be vetoed, the legislation that passed in the spring. Governor Quinn did, in fact, veto it, and there was talk of trying to do an override of that veto this fall, but Mike Zaleski instead said he negotiated with the Uber executives, people from the ride-sharing industry, and reached a verbal agreement to have these sort of minimum points that they're going to continue negotiating and really work to pass some kind of agreed piece of legislation before the end of the current General Assembly in January.
Amanda, other things you're watching there?
This is kind of the final opportunity for Democrats to get things through before Bruce Rauner takes over. So we're hearing a lot about maybe the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That is something that Illinois has never done its part in helping to get on there. There's talk about that being accomplished during the lame duck session. Some question, although union leaders have said, no, we don't know what you're talking about, of trying to get any sort of pro-labor initiatives through while Quinn is still in office. So those are at least two of the big ones that I'm trying to watch. You have basically it's the final opportunity for legislators to try and get things that were moving on through, but we already had one day of the veto session canceled. Much of this will wait until not the technical veto session, but presumably in early January when it takes fewer votes to pass legislation because of just how the rules are set up before the end of the year. So they'll do that presumably in early January, but before Bruce Rauner is inaugurated on the 12th.
That's our time for this edition of State Week. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org or search State Week in Review on iTunes or iTunes U. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.